2005, and we open a public hearing on House Bill 3474. Representative Sumner and Mr. Honeycutt, if you would come forward. Committee, we have seven people signed up to testify in this room.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it looks really different from this side of the table. This bill before you, House Bill 3474, uses as a basis the First Amendment of the United States Constitution that talks about the restriction of the free exercise of government, of churches, by government. We believe that it's pretty narrowly drafted, applies to a minimum number of people with a minimum impact on the land use planning. We of course agree with all the zoning and safety and all the features that protect property owners, such as setbacks, height additions, and the health and welfare of the surrounding neighborhood. This is almost taken verbatim from the state of Massachusetts laws. They have very similar law on their books. I am by no means an expert on this. I'm just very concerned about a number of churches, congregations throughout the state not being able to expand or build churches where they have chosen to do it. I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. Representative Sumner asked for some help on a draft of a bill to prohibit discrimination against churches in the form of zoning, which obviously led Congress to pass the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, and prior to that, the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, with that common political combination of Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch being the chief sponsors of the legislation. In an attempt to assist him in doing so, and because of the concerns that we've had when we've represented churches, both under Ray Lupa and back in the old days under RFRA, we helped with the drafting of House Bill 3474. The bill in front of you essentially prohibits the use of zoning to stop stop churches, with the exception contained in Section 2, Subsection 3 of the bill, which allows the public body to subject the real property to reasonable regulations relating to site review and design review and things of that nature. This bill is patterned and has language that I believe is identical to a subsection of a provision of the Massachusetts statutes that has been challenged or was challenged in federal court under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, specifically the Establishment Clause. And I've handed out a copy of the case where the First Circuit, the Federal First Circuit, held that the Massachusetts provisions, which mirror these, survived the constitutional test. And matter of fact, in the words of, I believe, of the court, clearly, we're within the scope of the Establishment Clause under the First Amendment. And that case is, it's too bad it's not Smith versus Jones. It's Boysian versus Gatsunis, 212 F3rd 1. The idea As most of you are, I'm sure, aware, the First Amendment to the Constitution has both an Establishment Clause and a Free Exercise Clause, which in many ways conflict. The idea that the government won't be involved in state-sponsored religion on the one hand, and on the other hand, the idea that the government won't interfere with somebody's religious beliefs on the other hand. And in many cases, as the court notes in this case, there are conflicting, whenever you talk about a legislation that somehow interferes or affects churches, there's a tension between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. The Oregon Constitution doesn't have, per se, an Establishment Clause. There are a number of provisions in the Oregon Constitution that deal with religion, and there's essentially a version of the Free Exercise Clause. About as close as you get to an Establishment Clause provision in the Oregon Constitution is found in Article 1, Section 5 of the Oregon Constitution. No money shall be drawn from the treasury for the benefit of any religious or theological institution, nor shall any money be appropriated for the payment of any religious services in either house of the legislative assembly. So the Oregon Supreme Court, when they've interpreted Establishment Clause cases or constitutional, Oregon constitutional challenges based on Establishment Clause principles, has adopted the Lemon Test, the Supreme Court's Lemon Test, to make a determination of whether or not there is a violation of the Oregon Constitution as well as the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court, when considering Establishment Clause challenges, has established a three-pronged test, and this comes out of Lemon versus Kurtzman, a 1971 Supreme Court case. And essentially, the test for whether a law is constitutional under the Establishment Clause is as follows. Number one, the law must reflect a clearly secular legislative purpose. Number two, it must have a primary effect that neither advances nor inhibits religion. And number three, it must avoid excessive government entanglement with religion. That's your three-pronged test under Lemon. And that's what this court, what the Second Circuit analyzed, or excuse me, the First Circuit analyzed when they were looking at this provision in Massachusetts statute when there was an Establishment Clause challenge to that. The third prong of the Lemon Test wasn't challenged in this case, and I don't think there's no reason to think that it would be challenged here. This bill certainly doesn't create excessive government entanglement with religion. To the contrary, it avoids government entanglement with religion, so we certainly meet the third prong of the Lemon Test with this particular piece of legislation, so it would survive that. The first two prongs, on the first prong, the law must reflect a clearly secular legislative purpose. What the court in the, what the First Circuit said in a challenge to the Massachusetts statute, was that, and I'm reading from the case as we go, we think the purpose of the Dover Amendment, which is the Massachusetts provision, fits easily within the established boundaries of benevolent neutrality, in which religious exercise is supported but not promoted, on the theory that prohibition of religious discrimination is unquestionably an appropriate secular legislative purpose. On the second prong of the Lemon Test, that the bill must have a primary effect that neither advances nor inhibits religion, the argument from the appellants, from the folks challenging the Massachusetts statute, was that the statute provides such a substantial advantage to religious institutions that, in effect, it constitutes an advancement of religion in violation of the Establishment Clause. And the court dismissed that as well, essentially saying, although the precise location of that threshold can be difficult to detect, we are confident that it has not been reached here. Appellant's depiction of the statute, you just put 3474 there, as an impermissible legal hammer wielded in favor of religion, both grossly exaggerates the reach of the statute and understates the recognition that religion may be given consistent with the Establishment Clause. The statute does not exempt religious property uses from substantial standard zoning requirements that are designed to ensure compatible uses with land. And so the court had no problem finding that the corresponding provision of Massachusetts law met with the establishment clause, survived an establishment clause challenge. And the U.S. Supreme Court refused to review the First Circuit's decision. Now, there have been arguments and a number of law review articles written over the years on the use of zoning as a way to discriminate against religious institutions, be they Christian or otherwise. And in fact, in many cases, it's not your predominant religion in the area that's being discriminated against. It's religions that that are attended by a minority, some minority group, not a racial minority, but just a limited number of adherents to that particular type of religious belief. And those are the folks that are being discriminated against because they're deemed to be different or outside of what we would normally, what the community thinks as a norm. In Oregon, in Oregon, I think one needs to look at, just as an example, the DL or LCDC's administrative rules relating to churches. What you'll see in LCDC administrative rules relating to churches is outside of urban growth boundaries into farmland, a church is not allowed within on high-value farmland within 3 miles of an urban growth boundary. At the same time, you can have a community center owned by a governmental agency or a nonprofit organization and operated primarily by and for residents of the local rural community within 3 miles of an urban growth boundary on high-value farmland. So I like to say, and I said this to Luba, we could have a nonprofit, a government-owned or a nonprofit organization-owned community center within 3 miles of an urban growth boundary that serves a predominantly rural population. We could have 500 people drive to that community center on Sunday from their rural areas, drive their cars out and park in their community center, in the community center parking lot, and they could go inside and they could play cards or they could watch football or they could read comic books or they could do any number of things. But if they start talking about God or something like that, then it becomes a church and it's no longer allowed it's no longer allowed under LCDC's rules. Clearly a content, a regulation based on content, and clearly one that we believe would violate the Free Exercise Clause and establishes a pattern of discrimination for religious institutions. It certainly did for one of my clients, the Malala Christian Church, which is also the church attended by the good representative sitting to my right. And so we believe that there's not just a pattern, but by rule alone, a demonstration of discrimination towards churches in Oregon as well, and certainly across the country as evidenced by law review articles. We think this is a good bill. Religious institutions, again, this bill doesn't apply just to a predominant religious institution. It applies to Christian churches, Muslim mosques, Jewish synagogues, Unitarians, whatever, the church of what's happening now, whatever it is, it applies. And so we think this is a very important bill. Churches perform, or religious institutions perform outstanding functions for so many folks in the community, and we think this is a very important bill, and I'm more than happy to help the representative, my friend to the right, in supporting this bill, and hope that it gets moved forward to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any questions? Representative Greenwood.
Yes, sir. I have a couple. First, I was trying to follow your torturous constitutional discussion there, and I think I followed it. But is there anything, have there been any constitutional challenges to the current status where most uses would be outlawed for buildings in a say, in an exclusive farm use zone, including churches and factories and until recently police departments and a variety of other things. Has that...
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenland, there hasn't been a challenge that I'm aware of to the, specifically to the Oregon zoning provisions, either an establishment, and a free exercise clause would be the challenge that a religious institution would bring against the Oregon provisions. We raised that issue in the Manila Christian Church case, but in the Manila Christian Church case, the evidence in the record, and you're on the record when you're in a LUBA proceeding, and we'll go back and demonstrate that the Manila Christian Church serves a predominantly rural population, but the evidence there wasn't there to demonstrate that they served a predominantly rural population. What LUBA said is in dicta was if you can demonstrate that the church serves a predominantly rural population, then this particular administrative rule has serious free exercise problems. It doesn't relate to the establishment clause. It's the other side of the religious parts of the First Amendment.
But has it been challenged anywhere? I mean, I understand your argument saying, well, in the Massachusetts case, therefore, this statute wouldn't be found. You're arguing probably wouldn't be found unconstitutional, but my understanding is land use laws have applied to churches across a variety of states, including probably Massachusetts, before this statute, and in any of them have they been found to be in violation of the free expression?
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenleg, without doing a sample of free exercise challenges across the 50 states, I can't give you an answer. As far as the Establishment Clause goes, a challenge by, for example, a municipality to one of these statutes. I think the Massachusetts statute is the, I believe, it was the only one that I could find that was a specific as far as the prohibitions that were allowed as this bill is. And so, of course, you've got the federal law, Ray Lupa, that's entered into the fray as well. But this Massachusetts statute has been around since 1950. And so it was the one, the template that we used, and this is the only case that I believe has been used to challenge that Massachusetts law.
Understood. I'm going to follow one more. Thank you. Tell me if I'm correct in my reading of Section 2, Sub 2, that if, say, Pacific University decided to move next week out into the farmland, there would be no way to use any of the statewide planning goals or zoning to stop that move of a nonprofit educational organization. I mean, one that might have, say, 25,000 students. Could we just go ahead under that clause and move Pacific or Willamette or something else off into the farmlands?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleg, under the reading of this measure, and I'm not sure Pacific University has 25,000 students, but under the reading of this measure, I think the answer to that is yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, the House Bill 3474 in your presentation is prefaced upon the fact that we're considering with the religious enterprises, yet I know that on line 9 it's really involves the use of real estate, real property for religious or educational purposes. Why do you incorporate educational purposes and give that some equality with religious purposes?
You want me to answer that,
please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, what we were trying to do with this bill was to mirror as closely as we can the language of the Massachusetts law, such that we wouldn't face an argument that the provisions of this bill differ from the Massachusetts law. Therefore, it may be the First Circuit's opinion doesn't necessarily stand to this law. We certainly, our organization, and I certainly don't pretend to speak for Representative Sumner, our organization would be fine with an amendment that specifies that the educational purposes are related to religion, so that we're talking about church schools or something of that nature, rather than just the way that I read this this language. It's an either or. The word or is there, the disjunctive, so it's an either or. But I think what the purpose, I think what the Massachusetts legislature was getting at here is the idea the church schools and things of that nature.
Second question, if I could, Mr. Chair. Looking at the situation statewide, is there a reasonable need to provide for a preferential siting of religious organizations to such an extent that we would repeal all land use regulations which apply to them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I can tell you that just from memory and I know this was dealt with in the 01 session, that there have been problems in the city of Portland, obviously with the Malala Christian Church case, in West Lynn with the LDS case that the Oregon Supreme Court just recently decided on RLUIPA grounds in West Lynn, in Jacksonville with a church that was holding weddings and funerals on weekends, and the city of Jacksonville was trying to restrain their ability to conduct those activities. So without going out to the religious community and getting, I'm sure there are other examples that exist, but those are just the ones off the top of my head that I can recall.
Last question, sir. Mr. Chair, thank you. It seems to me that the bill is based upon the nature of ownership of the original real estate, such that a nonprofit corporation, if a property was owned by a nonprofit corporation, then we could, without land use regulations, use it for religious purposes. Under that scenario, what's to stop a nonprofit shell corporation from buying my neighbor's house in the R1 area and then leasing it to a church for religious purposes? Don't you see that is some, do you think that produces some inequity or some chance for deception?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I think we would look to the state that has the experience, that has 54 years worth of experience with this particular statute, and look to see whether that situation has actually occurred in Massachusetts. And I'm certainly not aware of anybody using a long established and I think fairly well entrenched statute in Massachusetts for the purposes that you posit.
Thank you.
Any other questions of this panel? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Green, Christy Munson, and Director Shadowley. I'll let you begin.
Thank you. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Green. I'm a law professor at Willamette University College of Law. I teach areas of constitutional law, First Amendment law is my specialty, particularly church-state law. I've worked in this area for approximately 20 years, and prior to coming to Willamette 4 years ago, in fact, when I was in Washington, D.C., I helped write the RLUIPA statute that has been mentioned in the previous panel when it was working its way through Congress. I just want to say that I'm here on my own behalf, and I'm not speaking on behalf of any organizations. I'd like to make three comments about this particular bill. First, I believe this bill is unnecessary, that land use controversies between churches, religious organizations, and zoning commissions are already governed by the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. It provides, in my mind, a very vertical model for balancing these important issues between religious practice for exercise issues, and then also the important values that are represented in our land use laws that enhance the livability for all Oregonians. Without a doubt, churches sometimes, when they get in disputes with land use organizations, do end up losing their cases, but other times they do prevail. Cases have gone both ways under the religious land use bill. That in and of itself, though, I don't think necessitates the major revamping of law that would exist under this bill. The facts of the recent decision by the Oregon Supreme Court, in fact, indicate that the city was more than willing to work with the LDS Church on some alternative proposals. According to what the court said, there was no evidence that the city's decision against the church in this case was biased against religion, or the city's requirements were overly burdensome. I think the court was correct in its determination that the mere denial of conditional use permit is not a substantial burden on religious belief, on religious practice. Additional time, inconvenience, expense associated with resubmitting a petition does not constitute a substantial burden on religion. I am not, don't know of a single court out there that has found that that would constitute a substantial burden of religion. So as I said, sometimes they're going to be winners, sometimes they're going to be losers, but we have to realize that that's the way the law works. Second, I think this bill goes far beyond providing a level playing field that provides a balance between zoning laws and the rights of religious institutions. You need to realize that unlike the federal law, which includes a balancing between zoning and and religious institutions, this is an absolute grant of a right of religious institutions to be exempt from the zoning laws. There's no balancing that will go on here. As a result, this would dispense with what we like in the law, is to look at the value on both sides of the issue. This would dispense with that rule and be a carte blanche for religious and educational institutions. Also, what I find more troubling about this bill is, as someone just stated, this will deal with the character of the ownership. It will have nothing to do with whether, in fact, there's any proof at all or any showing at all that a church has in any way had its religious liberty interest infringed. You look at the bill, it doesn't say anything about there needs to be a burden on religion. Again, it is a flat grant. If it's a religious institution, even if there is no evidence at all that there's been any burden on religious practice, they are entitled to this type of exemption. Thus, as I say in my remarks, I don't see this as a religious liberty bill, because it is not, in its first instance, geared towards seeing if there is a religious liberty problem. And I disagree with Mr. Honeycutt. I actually do think this does raise some Establishment Clause concerns. I didn't look at the Massachusetts case before coming here. I read it a couple of years ago. I am familiar with the Dover Amendment. I believe it's somewhat broader than what is existing here. Also, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, as Mr. Honeycutt mentioned, relied somewhat on a finding that there was some form of religious discrimination that had gone on. This is just a bill that will apply to all religious institutions across the board here in Oregon. Whether, once again, there's been a finding of any kind of religious discrimination, any kind of burden on religious practice. If you're going to have a bill that respects religious liberty, it should at least have a requirement that there be some showing that there is a burden on religious practice. Third, I think the bill, if enacted, would have far-reaching and unintended consequences, as I think Representative Ackerman had at least implied in his questioning. What constitutes a religious organization that is eligible for this exemption? Religious organizations are more than just churches, synagogues, and mosques. Religious organizations own hospitals, nursing homes, halfway houses, sheltered workshops, rehabilitation centers, slaughterhouses, as well as parochial schools. We need to understand that there's a full gamut of organizations that would be covered by this particular bill. The potential impact of this exemption would be great. Conversely, how does the state go about determining what is, in fact, a religious organization? Both the U.S. and Oregon Supreme Courts have noted that there are some constitutional difficulties when you have governmental entities trying to define what and what is or is not religious. And as Representative Ackman said, there's nothing in this which stop your or my next door neighbor from setting up a church in their house and then being exempt from the zoning laws. So on one hand, the breadth of institutions that would be covered by this exemption are quite great. On the other hand, how you would go about limiting the application of this to those private groups that get together and say, we want to create a church and we're going to have it next door, we're going to have it in some place that is completely incompatible with that use, would be almost impossible for the state to make determinations of whether it was religious or not. As a result, I would urge you to reject this proposed legislation.
Committee will wait till the entire panel has concluded speaking, and then we'll ask questions. Ms. Munson.
Thank you, Chair Garrard, members of the committee. My name is Christy Munson. I'm counsel for the League of Oregon Cities, and we have some serious concerns about this bill also. First, I'd like to address, and this will only take about 5 minutes, I'd like to address what this bill is not. It is not a small change in how we regulate religion. It is not just a burden shift. It is not something that just minutely changes the law. This is a major revamping, as the professor has said, of how we regulate land in Oregon, and I'll tell you why. Let's just go through the bill really quickly. It addresses that we can have no regulation of the use of real property for religious or educational purposes. Religion nor education is not defined. They're not defined. If the property is owned or leased by one, a public body, two, a religious organization, or three, a nonprofit educational organization. They're very broad groups. They're not necessarily just religious groups. Additionally, the regulation doesn't have to impinge upon an act that's central to somebody's religion. As you've heard from the professor, it doesn't have to impinge upon religion at all. It just goes to the ownership. And the entities that are allowed to own, again, are public bodies, religious organizations, or nonprofit educational organizations. We're a little unclear as to how that's supposed to target religious freedom. Secondly, there are exceptions. We're not clear as to how broad the exceptions are, but they say that an exception can be made for reasonable regulations regarding the physical characteristics of a building. It's fairly broad. We're unclear about that exception. I also just wanted to note for you what kind of city ordinances may be impacted by this, and we would not be able to regulate these bodies. But we're talking about things as simple as noise ordinances, business license, health and safety regulations. A lot of churches have daycare, so daycare regulations, traffic flow around churches, nuisance laws. We're talking about very broad regulations that could affect your neighbors and your citizens and your communities. The ultimate effect of legislation, anytime you have legislation that naturally favors one group of people over another, are lawsuits from the other side. We will, we believe, see anti-establishment lawsuits if we go ahead and pull back on regulations that are put upon one set of people. So if we pull back from regulations on religious organizations, we will get anti-establishment lawsuits from their neighbors who perhaps don't belong to that religious organization. So the use of public funds, public time, should be considered when you pass legislation like this. Lastly, it's not a good neighbor piece of legislation because of that, and we want you to be well aware of that. Good policy involves balancing, and most religious freedom legislation that you see, federal, state, Massachusetts, Oregon, or otherwise, has a balancing test where you balance certain groups of citizens' rights against other groups of citizens' rights, and we don't see that here, and we feel that good policy would involve a balancing choice. I guess that's all we have to say, but we're happy to take any questions later.
Director Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I should also mention, just in terms of where I come from and approaching this bill, I have been counsel to a school district involved in school location issues, and I'm a member of a congregation in Dallas that is in the process of relocating the church facility. So this is something that I have a little bit of perspective, I think, from both sides. Having said that, the hat I'm wearing here today is that as director of the department, and we do want to express concerns about the bill. I think you've heard several of the concerns that we would have already expressed. I think that one has to understand in concept that what this bill constitutes is really a superseding bill in favor of public bodies, religious organizations, and non-profit educational organizations. First, as to public body, we do require under Oregon land use law now that public bodies act compatibly with Oregon's land use laws. In terms of good neighbor issues, I think there would be an issue certainly if a public body decided to exempt itself from laws that it's going to hold its citizens to relative to the location and use of public facilities. And I think it's also important to note that the nonprofit educational organization is substantially broader than what you may conceive of in terms of school. We know that advocacy groups, political organizations, other groups that you don't think of as schools do form nonprofit educational adjunct organizations that become associated with the political advocacy purpose of the organization, and those would fall, I believe, under this definition of nonprofit educational organization as well. So you have an issue of superseding into the breadth of the scope of this bill. And I think I would just underscore what you heard from Christy in particular in terms of what this amounts to in relative to demands on government, the allowance of siting under this bill without regard to availability of services, transportation, public infrastructure, and without regard to impacts on conflicting or neighbor uses as well. I think all underscore why we have some sideboards around even the location of these beneficial and very good public uses. With that, Mr. Chair, I think I've pretty well expressed our concerns about this, except to say that we are working in the development of LULPA. You've heard testimony about that in this state already. We've got a couple of cases coming through that are beginning to establish what the sideboards are under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act here in Oregon. I believe that Professor Green is correct that the federal law is nuanced. It's carefully balanced in terms of the burden as opposed to the impact and rights of religious organizations in particular, and believe that that provides the level of protection that's appropriate and I think satisfies the needs that would be met in this bill without creating the host of unintended consequences, perhaps, that I believe would flow from the adoption of this bill. So thank you very much.
Any questions of this panel? Representative Greenlee.
Yes, Ms. Munson, did I understand you to say that, for example, this bill would prevent the city of Portland from regulating anything that OHSU and PSU do in there? In their land use and other uses of their campuses?
Chair Garrard, Representative Greenlick, under certain circumstances, they may. If those bodies are public bodies, religious organizations, or nonprofit educational organizations, and their use of real property for religious or educational purposes, there is a possibility under this bill that we could not regulate them, and they would be exempt from many of our regulations.
You mean we could have gotten that tram without all this fuss?
Yeah.
I think you might get a couple of other advocates for this bill.
Any other questions from the Representative Atkin?
I just have a question that's sort of in the category of looking for the silver bullet, but do any of you know whether the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act has preemptive language, that is, the preempt state statutes of a similar effect?
Chair Garrard, Representative Ackerman, I'd have to just look that up. I can't remember for sure whether it actually has any preemption. I don't think it does, from what I understand. The predecessor, the rep, did not have preemption, and I believe, without checking it, I believe it doesn't preempt state law.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Dwayne, I have one for you that, yes, if you choose not to answer it, That's entirely okay. I've never seen you do that, but setting aside that you are a director of land use in Oregon, but as a member of your congregation, would you support this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I will take that question on, and I think my answer to that would be no. I think getting back to Christie's comments, I think organizations such as churches and schools and nonprofits need to be good neighbors and need to be prepared to live within the scope of laws that apply generally to the public, and I think that is a standard that helps engender public trust and support and confidence in those institutions when they're seen as playing by the same rules as apply to their neighbors.
Thank you for your response.
Yes. Appreciate that.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Information. Harkening back to a few years ago, what zones is the church not able to be zoned in? Isn't a church or a religious body able to be zoned pretty much in each residential, commercial, or industrial?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, Ron Eber is in the back of the room. I hope Stella may be better able to answer that than I.
But he doesn't look like
he's here. and then maybe that's a question for a city person, if you're especially we're talking about. Yeah, sorry, Christy. I think there are. I think churches can be cited as conditional uses in zones that are not specific to commercial or something that might otherwise apply. But I think there are limits in that respect.
Chair Garrard, Representative Anderson, I don't have the answer to the question. I can get it for you, but I do know that there have been churches cited outside the UGB, and they get the designation of rural churches. And so there are areas where they're cited outside the UGB. But I can get more specific information for you later.
Representative Anderson, is your office to call Mr. Eber forward to see if he...
For sure.
Ron, would you come up, please? Pamela, you're excused. Thank you very much.
I'll stay, if I may, Mr. Chair, just with
you. Well, he doesn't need any protection.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Munson, I might have a follow-up from Ms. Munson.
Oh.
On this answer,
okay.
So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, Ron Eber for the department. At least on the rural side of the question, our rules preclude churches and schools within 3 miles of an urban growth boundary or on high-value farmland. Under forest zoning, churches and schools are not allowed at all. And I think the general policy is that Goal 14 does not allow urban uses outside of an urban growth boundary. And although we have no specific rules to that effect, there would be an argument or discussion if someone wanted to propose an urban church or school outside of an urban growth boundary, say on rural residential or some other rural land, it would be precluded.
Thank you. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The earlier question was specifically addressing a church building used for services, but I believe, Ms. Munson, that you said that under this proposed bill, the exemption from local regulations applies to any property owned by one of these institutions, regardless of its use. So my question is, currently, if a church or educational institution owns a shopping mall or a halfway house or something like that, that has to meet current zoning. But under this bill, would those uses be allowed in any zone?
Representative Nolan, members of the committee, there's actually two tests in this bill. The property has to be used for religious or educational purposes, and it has to be owned or leased by one of three bodies: public body, religious organization, or nonprofit education organization. The challenge with these definitions is they're undefined. So we don't really know what a religious or educational purpose is. And I'll tell you, I advocate for cities to be able to define their actions, but I don't think you want government defining what a religious action is, and I don't think you want us saying what an educational purpose is. I think that such guidance in such important legislation should be provided in law. The other thing to note is that, yes, it does go to ownership of the body. So public body, religious organization, or non-profit educational organization has to own or lease the land. Non-profit educational organizations are growing very rapidly. As a matter of fact, a lot of political advocacy organizations are non-profit educational organizations. So I would urge you, if you are a religious freedom advocate, to consider how broad that group is. It's not necessarily going to be just churches.
Representative Summer. Sir, under current land use rules, do you suppose today let's say, for instance, the Catholic Church would be permitted to build, or let's say my district, Mount Angel Abbey and Convent? Definitely religious, definitely educational, to a degree owned by the community, a part of the community. I don't believe under today's land use laws that would even be permitted.
Mr. Chair, sorry, Representative Sumner, I'm not sure, what the question comes to mind, just directly answering your question, is whether the Abbey is within the urban growth boundary of Mount Angel, in which case then the zoning would be accommodated within the city's zoning. So, to specifically answer your question, I don't know. We did, in fact, I was a bill, I think, in 1999. Well, that was non-hazardous farmland, I guess, to allow the establishment of churches on 5 acres or less to accommodate rural congregations in rural zones. So certainly that bill is in force and does apply. If I may, Mr. Chair, on the issue of the breadth of these definitions and unintended consequences, I am reminded of a bill that I was involved in 1999, I think, where the organization, you may know them, Project Vote Smart, wanted to establish its world headquarters under the statute allowing for a community center in rural Benton County, and was opposed by the neighbors in the vicinity, and made the argument in front of the County Planning Commission that, in fact, it came under the definition of community center because it represented a global community. And it actually persuaded the Planning Commission that that was an allowable use to allow a global community to establish what would have been dormitories and a study center and library for Project Vote Smart in rural Benton County. And that was the situation that engendered the amendment to that statute that required that the community center serve the rural community, to make clear that that was not the intended use. But that just underscores how broadly terms such as those that are used in this bill can be employed by those who are inclined to.
Yeah, I want to follow up. Oh, noisy out there. I want to follow up Representative Sumner and Anderson's question, because I sensed it was about the extent to which building a church is restricted inside the city as well as outside the city. This is talking about, ostensibly about talking about siting churches outside of the urban growth boundary, but are there problems siting churches inside urban growth boundaries in terms of the kinds of uses that are allowed? I mean, I'm sure sometimes it's hard to get the piece of land you want and that sort of thing, but is there a problem siting churches inside the urban growth boundary under current statutes? Or
Chair Gerard, Representative Green, like, I don't particularly know about the specific siting, and but I do know about some problems that have happened with governmental regulations regarding churches inside the UGB, which this bill addresses. Although it does address siting, it addresses all kinds of regulations, noise ordinances, health and safety regulations, etc. And some of the things that have happened in cities are regarding churches with who are very successful, wonderful neighbors, for the most part, very successful and have crowding or are serving food to the needy. And so sometimes government health and safety regulations apply or fire code apply. And so trying to make sure that rules that are generally applicable to all members are fairly applied to churches and not discriminatory is really what we're looking for. And that kind of balancing is what's needed, and this statute doesn't necessarily provide it. I'm sorry, I can't answer your citing question, though.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, Representative Sumner can probably answer your question, because I think that was what drove the Malala Christian Church to be looking outside the UGB. It was an issue of land supply within the urban growth boundary. So I think that underscores, goes back to the need for cities to maintain adequate land supplies within the urban growth boundary, because I think on some discrete cases, there may be issues of adequate land supply within the urban growth boundary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question for Mr. Eber. Do you do land use applications based on ownership as to the applicant? Because everyone's saying that these might be religiously affiliated, and I'm wondering if we do land use applications in the state by ownership.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we don't get applications actually at the state level, but we review those. If there was a criteria for approval that went to the ownership issue, then that would be information that would have to be provided. So, for instance, currently in 215.705, there is an owner lot of record provision, and people then have to bring forward that they have the appropriate ownership as of a given date and time. So it really depends on the criteria involved. If it involves an ownership issue, then people would have to bring that forward.
Thank you.
Sir, if I could return to the UGB, sir, that was absolutely accurate. The problem with a small town becoming larger, it traps itself inside of the UGB. All of the available lands, if there are big enough parcels, are way beyond the financial means of a small group of people. If you're trapped in a half-block area that don't provide adequate parking, that don't provide adequate space for the people that come to the church, you're compelled to get out of the UGB, and therein lies our problem.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, and Representative Sumner, I'll ask for your help to make sure I get this right, but my recollection of the RLUIPA decision in the Malala Christian Church case was that RLUIPA did not come into play yet, because the city had not availed itself of an exception process in which it could have demonstrated that there was no land inside the UGB, and so that this place outside the UGB was appropriate and necessary under the circumstances. So that, when Luba sent Malala Christian Church back, it was basically with the door open to apply for an exception in order to demonstrate that those conditions existed that disallowed the location of the church within the UGB and made it appropriate. So I think that gets back to how RLUIPA ties in with land use planning program to accommodate those needs, so that rather than just a super siting decision under a statute like this, so the church can demonstrate is that in fact the application of the laws, given the limit on land supply, do constitute a substantial burden that would then justify, justify an exception to the location requirements, and then allow the church to locate.
If I might, Mr. Chair, Representative Sumner, I'm also aware of an exception that was approved for a church outside, I believe, the city of Amity that had exactly that situation. It was a small community. They could demonstrate that there simply wasn't an alternative, and they got an exception approved.
Yes, sir. Seeing no further questions, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Randy Tucker, Philip Kennedy Wong, and Ilan Hassan. This will be our final panel on this bill.
You called me first, Mr. Chair.
Let's let Ilan go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ilan has.
I'm moving to the left.
I'm on the far right from your
perspective. No, you're not.
Ilan Hassan, for the record, Ilan Hassan, lobbyist for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. 1,000 Friends of Oregon opposes HB 3474 for many of the reasons articulated earlier by Professor Green and others. HB 3474 is written, we're concerned about the definition of what a religion would be within policing it, which organizations are actual religions, which aren't, which uses are actual religious uses, which are not, would be problematic and burdensome. We also feel that the federal law, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, already protects religious organizations from land use restrictions that impose substantial burden on the exercise of their religion. So, for those reasons, we oppose the bill.
Mr. Wong.
Thank you, Chair Garrard, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Philip Kennedy Wong, representing Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. We are the State Association of Churches, representing 17 Christian denominations. Our mission is the unity and common good of all people in this world. And let me just start off by thanking Representative Sumner for his intention of advancing the cause of religious freedom, which is something that we support very much. One of our beliefs as an ecumenical body, because we have 17 different denominations, is that one of the important things is that religions should have the ability to worship in the manner they deem appropriate to their faith. We also believe that as religious bodies, we obviously integrate within communities as part of our ministry. And one of the things that a lot of our churches like to do is to become good neighbors, not just good neighbors, but to be a cornerstone of any community that we find our churches in. Unfortunately, after reviewing this bill, as it's written, we cannot support it. When we reviewed this bill, we weighed the importance of the rights of a religious body to develop land, also weighed against our religious calling and belief of preserving and protecting the earth as one of our moral mandates. And the reason why that's a very important part of our religious beliefs is that we believe that sustaining the earth is important for sustaining life for future generations. So when we weighed these decisions, we did not conclude that the right to develop land was an undue hardship on our ministries, that the importance of sustaining the earth and respecting statewide planning goals as important and worthy tool for protecting the earth, that this was that this bill, as it's written, would present some potential problems. We believe that the statewide planning goals, for the most part, are important in terms of that religious belief, in terms of ours of protecting the earth. And we also believe that given the present federal protections under RLUIPA, that they are sufficient. The bill as written, as we reviewed it, it is too broad. And we recognize that each situation that a church finds itself as it innovates within a community is unique. And the way the bill is written, it's sort of like one size fits all. And it's not that we're opposed to religious freedom, but that we are concerned about how this bill may be misused by other groups, perhaps masking or parading under the guise of religious purpose. And then lastly, we also recognize that in this world there are many religions, both large and small, and there may be some concern in terms of how this may be used in terms of the tensions that unfortunately exist between many religions of the world. And for that,
we are opposed to overall House Bill 3474. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Tucker?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Metro Legislative Affairs Manager. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Metro also has concerns about House Bill 3474. I'll just be very brief. I've got a few stories here that my colleagues have provided to me. Be glad to provide them in more detail to you. Basically, there are three churches that have been that I've learned about. They've been located outside the metro urban growth boundary. In each case, they were located there by the county. These are all Washington County examples, as a matter of fact, as rural churches. In each case, in fact, they were serving an urban population. In each case, after the church was located outside the urban growth boundary, because it was serving that urban population, it was growing. There were added uses that were sought, there were septic failures, etc., and eventually there were requests to bring the land into the urban growth boundary. In one of the cases, that was done, in two of the cases, that was not done. So you have a situation where churches locating outside the urban growth boundary, theoretically to serve the rural community, ended up sort of driving, driving urban growth boundary expansions in that direction. Another problem with this situation is something we encountered in the effort to provide adequate industrial land in the region last year. You may recall me talking about that here before. Metro Council added a couple thousand acres of land for industrial purposes. However, in a couple of those cases, the direction of logical expansion for industrial purposes encountered churches that were in the land outside the urban growth boundary, and there was opposition to the expansion for those industrial purposes for that reason, even though it was otherwise exactly the right direction to go. In one case, that land was brought in another case, it wasn't. So some things that haven't been discussed previously in this hearing, where I think a lot of other issues have been thoroughly aired. Just wanted to get those on the record, and I'd be glad to try to answer any questions or go back and get the answers for you if I don't know them.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Kenny Ward, if I happen to be a Native American and I wish to have a teepee in which I had a sweat lodge on the same property that, for instance, this group wanted to build on, would that be allowable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, are you asking me with respect to House Bill 3474?
Yes.
Well, I'm not sure what legal status, Native American tribes would fall under. I'm not a scholar on Native American legal issues.
Okay, let's say there was a New Age group that wanted to get together and worship on a Friday afternoon on that same piece of property. Is that legal?
Under this, Chair Gard, under this bill?
Yeah.
To answer your question, I think what you've hit upon is one of the legal challenges to define what constitutes a bona fide religion. And to my understanding, the courts have not done, a fair enough of an assessment of what is technically a religion institution, because in the work that I do, I often work with different religious organizations on an interfaith basis, even though we're a Christian organization. And occasionally there will be groups that states that they are a religious group that some of our members wouldn't necessarily define as religious. So I think with this bill as it's written, because of this lack of clarity as to what constitutes a religious body, it is problematic. I mean, that's how we would read it with relation to this bill.
Thank you. Wow.
You made the point, I heard you make the point, that the land is, in God's eyes, very important, that we should be stewards of it, and that we shouldn't value a building over the land. Is that correct?
Sure, Lord, Representative Anderson. Close, yes. I mean, in a sense that
One more question.
You know, religion exists on a spiritual level, and it's not necessarily the physical structures that religious bodies inhabit that make it a religion. But also on a very theological level, there is the moral command that our members have in terms of protecting God's creation. So with respect to that, we recognize that when you look at the importance of sustaining the planet for future generations, for life, that we can, within reason, examine how we use the land with respect to that calling.
Thank you. My question then is, have we committed a major sin in allowing churches and synagogues and mosques to be built on the land of America?
Chair Gerard, Representative Anderson, my answer is no. I mean, I think it depends on, obviously, the circumstances and the purposes for which those institutions are using the land. Obviously, the land is very important. People must have a place to build their homes, to have a place to worship, to do their business. So that is not against, in terms of our membership, against our religious beliefs, that using the land for those purposes goes against our tenets.
So it was not a problem in the past, but it is for situations like this.
Chair Gerard, Representative Anderson, we believe that now, with respect to this bill, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And I think as you find, you know, different situations where the church becomes entangled with the state, that there may be situations where there is some reasonable approaches that churches can implement in order to be good neighbors and not to infringe or harm other communities nearby. That's not to say that churches in the future or in the present are violating their belief of preserving the earth.
Thank you.
Committee, the two things you don't want to talk about are religion and land use.
And water. And Lieutenant Smith and the exotic animals.
He didn't.
Are there any further questions of this panel? Thank you very much. I think the committee understands and represents. Summer has agreed that the bill probably needs a little work. And Representative Summer, we hope you'll bring the bill back to the committee when that work is completed. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3474 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 887A.
Sir? Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 887A is one that's been referred to you from the Senate Environment and Land Committee and also from the Senate body itself. This is a lengthy bill. It has numerous sections. I'll quickly go through them to highlight them. What the bill essentially will do will prohibit the city of Beaverton from conducting any annexations that do not have the consent of property owners in the area that's proposed to be annexed. That has a sunset date of 08. In Section 3, you'll notice that the annexation plans that are conducted under ORS 195, and we had talked about that one, I think, in House Bill 2484, they're to be submitted only to the electors of the territory be proposed to be annexed. Current statutes had the for the area to be annexed as well as the citizens, and then the 2484 was for a double majority. This would just remove that and say if the area proposed for annexation. There's a provision in here in Section 4 that would require during the interim that there would be a committee formed to look at a number of annexation-related issues. There is the Sections 5 and 6. They both pertain to certain properties with unique characteristics that would prohibit the annexation of those properties, and each has a sunset clause of 2020. Basically, Section 6 talks about, and I would urge you to look at those because they have a number of caveats based on where the land is located, its size, is it industrial designation, how many employees are working on a particular piece of property. So they pertain to particular piece of properties that aren't mentioned. Section 8 also would require
that there would be an annexation boundaries work group that would mediate any contentious annexation issues, and it specifically in Section 9 requires the City of Beaverton to make use of this project process. There is also a number of dash amendments that we received. This, earlier this morning, a dash 12 was received, which would essentially replace the bill. It would, in the dash 12s, it would repeal ORS 222-750, and that is a section that allows cities to do island annexations. Those are annexations where the city limits surround a particular property or properties. That would be in the dash 12 prohibited. Dash 12 would make use of an interim committee that would review other annexation issues. There's a dash 10 and a dash 11 which came in just at the meeting time, and a dash 13 also right at the meeting time from Senator Deckards, and I believe that he may be here who could address 13. I'm not sure where 11 and 12 came from. They came right at the meeting.
12 came from me.
Excuse me, 10 and 11.
You're right. 11 came from, I think
not only do we want to hear what the bill is all about today, but try to have a brief synopsis on each amendment that we have before us and who presented those amendments. As we mentioned, we're up to 13 amendments on this bill. So I'm going to... Yes.
Did one of your members, were they amendments that were considered in the Senate before VA examined? So the first one we have is
Yeah, previous numbers, I believe, would have reflected through the Senate side.
Through the Senate side. And Senator Lemon was obvious, I think.
I don't think you're correct.
Dash.
So there are amendments to the dash A version of the bill. But I don't know.
11, yeah. I was just asking, how many numbers lower than that were already?
I think those are the ones we started with, yeah. I believe so. I'm not aware of anything underneath 10. Senator Barkins. He's here.
We have a lot of people signed up to talk on this bill, but obviously, I think it's important that we take things first step by step, and that is to identify who has introduced the amendments and what the amendments to the bill do before we accept testimony on the bill, because we don't even know at this point what the final bill will look like. So who, sounds kind of silly, but... Okay. Representative Bavakian, you have...
8-9.
Well, I was just told by administration that we started the amendments with 10, so...
I didn't know about the 8-9.
Were they hand-grossed? Uh-huh. 8-9.
You have...
We don't have those. We started at 10,
11, 12, and 13 that we're provided with.
Are they in the
okay.
We have
6. You have 6?
We are there, sir.
The committee will stand at ease while the administrator figures out the amendments. on land use. And while we're still figuring out the amendments, I'll ask Senator Decker to please come forward. If Tom Gallagher will let him go.
Senator, thank you and welcome to you.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Sumner, Representative Ackerman, Vice Chair Greenwood, and Vice Chair Gordon Anderson of Grants Pass, I believe. Good to see you. I have, and I'm only going to take maybe 2 minutes of your time because I think I have a minor amendment that got included in Senate Bill 887 that I think is a really good idea on a storm that has been brewing up in Representative Greenwick in my neck of the woods, which is Washington County, around annexation and the city of Beaverton. My goal with this amendment, we just gave you some wordsmithing, and it's included in the Dash 813 amendments, some wordsmithing of it, but the intent of it is to get folks that have been really talking, I guess, against each other and past each other and get them into a room in a mediation process, and that's what we included in the Senate bill, is get a mediation process and actually have a formal process where these folks actually start talking. And that's where the suggestion came from, is that you would have some sort of mediation process. What we did at the request of at least a couple of House members, and what I heard was the chair's request also, was we took out the Hatfield School and just made it a neutral party, but without identifying who that neutral party would be. And then at the request of and some of the suggestions that Representative Greenwood made, we added a little more clarity of who in those unincorporated affected areas would be and how we would choose those representatives. So that's all included in the 813. I think it's a clean amendment that actually better perfects what we were after, which is basically to get the folks in a room talking for the next 2 years where we know no annexation is going to happen in the city of Beaverton, but it'd be a far better process than what we've had. And Representative Greenwood got the experience, which is these town hall meetings with 300 angry citizens, which folks that have been in local government know these well. Fortunately, I don't. And it's a shouting match. And there's just got to be a better forum to have these discussions. And I think hopefully the 813s would give us those just in our little area up in Washington County.
So any questions of Senator Wagner? Representative Greenwick.
Brian, this isn't for good as we talk. I'm still a little concerned, and I think we need to still perfect this when we get to it, is what happens with that report? What happens if they reach impasse? And as I meet 13, it still isn't clear. I mean, this isn't a mandatory mediation, I take it. It's if after 150 days, the Cedar Hills residents are still saying, screw you, Beaverton, and Beaverton is still saying, we're going to gobble you up. What happens at that point?
Yeah. It's not binding in that sense, where the hope is that, you know, through conversations, Chair Garrard and Representative Vice Chair Green, like, through a better process, you're going to get at least the acrimony will go down and better environment for actually give and take. But at the end, what we wrote, although I'm happy, I actually would request that this committee put its mind to this issue if you have the willingness to perfect it, because I'm not married to, but what we came up with is that neutral, that third party would then write a report and basically help adjudicate the issue if they can't, if the scenario you laid out actually occurs and they're still, you know, maybe they're 10 miles apart now, hopefully they're 2 miles apart, but on that final 2 miles, perhaps then that neutral party would then let the legislature and the task force that might be working on this very issue with cities and with the state, they would let them know, here are your options available, and here's what I recommend as that neutral party.
Talk some more about it. You now talk some more about it.
Any other questions of the good senator? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Time.
Sam, let's... We'll almost have to have a program for the amendments with the numbers and names attached. We've identified all but amendments 10 and 11.
We have a 7?
No.
Okay, that's...
Oh, Gary Conkle. Both 10 and 11 are yours, Gary?
Okay. Yeah, we have a 10 and 11. It's a 7 that's missing, I think.
Yeah, and 7. That was never presented.
Seven is
not
five. Okay, five. And 10 and 11 is who it came from is the question.
Right there, gentleman back, I think his name is Jack Conley, I think.
Committee, what we have then is slide to the left, last bill. Senator, the dash 13 amendment to Senator Deckard's. The dash 6 belong to Mr. Barrows.
Mm-hmm.
The dash 8s and 9s are Representative Ivakian's.
Right.
The dash 10 and 11s are Mr. Conklin's, and the dash 12s are Representative Greenlick. So that's...
And it turns out Representative Ackerman ordered essentially the same one.
Well, it's not published. It does have a number, so it's not important right now.
But it's coming.
I might pull it.
Well,
I think it's noted already.
Representative Ivakian, would you like to come forward on the dash 8s and 9s, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad Ivakian, State Representative, District 34, Washington County. Let me do the dash 8s first. The dash 8s simply delete Section 9 from the original bill. Section 9 is the one that relates to the mediation process that dictates that the city of Beaverton must participate in mediation. That is contrary to the rest of the cities in the state of Oregon there, in which it is optional. I think all the cities should be treated fairly. So Section dash 8 simply deletes that section. The dash 9s, the intent behind dash 9 was to maintain the intent of the mediation process, but simply to help clean it up a little bit. And if you'd like, I can very quickly just move through the
jurors, if you would.
First, it decreases the size of the committee from 10 to 6 individuals, just to make it a more manageable work group. It also changes in Section 1 the language that says that an elector can object to the annexation and start the process for a work group. I changed that from 1 to 50 just so that you don't have one individual who can bind everybody into a certain process. Frankly, after doing that, I changed my mind yet again. I think it would be better to have a percentage of individuals rather than the 50 in case you have less than 50 people in the annexing territory. That's something for the committee to consider. Under Section 3, similar to Senator Deckard's change, I allow for a majority vote of the individuals on the committee to choose a mediator so that there's some process by which they can work by, and then also deleted the reference to the Hatfield School of Government. Then in Section 4, simply cleaned up the timelines, 150 days, same as Senator Deckard's, clarified that 30 days after that 150 days is the time period, is the second time period for action, and then also clarified that the individual serving on the future boundary work group are to receive a decision of the mediator. Those are the only changes. I would like to comment also, Mr. Chair, that this mediation process, I think, is an important one for the committee to consider. It isn't binding in any respect. It's optional on the part of the cities, even if requested by people subject to the annexation. So there really is no teeth in it. Sometimes you can end up with a good product by going through a process like that. Sometimes when you go through a mediation process that has no definitive result, it exacerbates the situation. So if what you're looking for is something that actually resolves the issue between the parties, I'm not sure that this gets you there.
Any questions of Representative Ackerman? Representative Ackerman.
Just for my clarification, does a mediation have the effect of staying the annexation election?
I would not read my amendments or the original bill that way.
Go forward, and mediation takes place. It seems to me that's across purposes.
I would agree, which is why I think some of the other bills in addition to 887 are important for the committee to consider.
Thank you.
Any other questions of Representative Ivakian? Seeing none, thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Escobar wishes to testify You mean you don't have an amendment?
I do not, so this will be very congenial.
I have a handout here, though. For the record, Sal Escobar, Representative District 6, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'd like to take a little bit of time here to, you know, you've had a lot of amendments here. You have a lot of reactions to what has transpired here in a couple of municipalities. And there's a couple things I would like to make very clear is that, one, most municipalities function quite well with their annexation and with their procedures, their comprehensive plans, their traffic studies, etc. Now, one thing I want to address, though, is enclaves. We have to be very, very careful when we deal with enclaves. And I understand abuse of an enclave, and I understand the correct procedure of an enclave. Sometimes you will, through your infinite wisdom, create an enclave. Now, I'm not sure what the municipalities in your particular districts, how they go about it, but I will explain to you how we do it in the city of Medford, which I represent. We do not force people to come into the city limits, except on a 10-year basis when they're an island and it's an enclave. We allow property owners, whether that be a half an acre, a 10-acre piece, or a 5-acre piece, they apply and ask to come into the city. We grant that, and we allow it. Then we change their zoning according to the zoning change that they would like to have the use of the property. It has to correspond with, our, of course, our comprehensive plan. Now, once we have done this, occasionally you'll have, and the criteria is you have to be contiguous to the city. So this property that's being annexed has to be contiguous to the city limits themselves, has to be in the urban growth boundary. That's two criteria. Now, the handout that I just gave you gives you an idea of how this works when maybe two or three property owners, they don't want to be in the city at that time. So we do not force them to do so. But every 10 years, we shall go through and do forced annexations on enclaves. And the reason being is because you can see how these islands are starting to be created just in this one particular area. And this is the southwest part of Medford. And you can see up here on the SR 2.5, that's still a county zoning. The rest of this is in the city. So what you end up doing is you will eventually end up with one piece of property, maybe an acre or 2 acres or maybe even 5 acres. So it will be completely surrounded by the city, and the city limits will be way past it. Those people enjoy the services of the city. They have the infrastructure. They have the water and sewer at that particular time. So we do a forced annexation. So what I'm saying is that we have to be very, very careful on what we craft, that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I understand with annexations of roads around particular entities, that's a misuse. I understand when an organization tries to bring in a large industrial entity just for a tax base. I think that's a misuse as well. And I will like to add that Medford at this particular time has 3, maybe even 4 large corporations that are either contiguous or islands within the city. One of them is Timber Products. The city's grown way past Timber Products, but it's still in the county. Because if we brought Timber Products into the municipality, the tax base, you would probably lose that entity. And it creates, I believe, around 350 family wage jobs that pays $14 an hour or more. Very good base. The other one, believe it or not, is Hillcrest Orchards. Hillcrest Orchards is 240 acres right in the middle of Medford. Still an orchard, and it's still a functional orchard. They've turned into a winery. It's a flourishing business. But this last time we did our regional problem solving in order to expand our urban growth boundary and our reserve, they did request to be part of that expansion. And the reason being is because they're not sure that they can financially keep their business going. That's 240 acres. It's completely surrounded by the city. The other one's Bear Creek Corporation, and many of you have probably heard of that. It's getting right next to the city limits. We have no intention whatsoever of annexing Bear Creek Corporation. It's the largest employer in Southern Oregon, I believe. In its height, it employs about 5,800 people. So that gives you some examples of how we go about annexation and how important enclaves are. We use it as a last resort. We use it once every 10 years, but we still need to have that tool in our box in order to have a functional city. And I'm going to give you a real good example of how sometimes it's non-functional. We had a piece out on Crater Lake Highway by Costco, which those of you who are familiar that have been there understand that that's a pretty big area that's been annexed into the city. And there was one particular piece, it was 3 acres, that we had a bankruptcy on the business. I was dispersing the property for the trustee, and during that time on my watch, somebody broke in, stole the tires off of a pickup, which, okay, fine. They jacked it up, took all the tires off, and they're set. I called the Medford Police Department. This is next to Costco out there on Clear Lake Avenue. It was in the county.
So I had to turn around and
call the county. That's what happens when you have an enclave. The county had to do the investigation. So, anyway, those are some of the problems you have when you allow enclaves. But I'm just saying, let's be very conscious of that as a tool to a municipality. And then I know Representative Anderson's been in a municipality. He's shaking his head. He understands the guy. And Representative Sumner. So anyway, I just ask you to consider that very closely when we talk about annexations. The other thing that we need to look at is if you have a double majority and you have someone that's on an island that gets all the services from the city, why would they want to vote to come into a city? They already have the luxury of the city infrastructure. So, anyway, keep that in mind, and I appreciate it. Any questions?
Any questions of Representative Esquivel? Sal, I think you're aware that we do have Senate Bill 699.
Yes, sir.
We'll be heading over.
And I think I've spoken with you, Mr. Chair, on that, that's a good bill.
We'll look forward to receiving it.
Okay. Thank
you for your testimony. Okay, back to the amendments. Where do we leave off, Sam?
We had 13, 8, 9, so we got 6, 10, 11.
Okay, Amendment 6 is state bills. By the way, committee, we have, I think everyone received a letter from Leupold and Stevens, which is a company that apparently was annexed into the city of Beaverton 9 days ago over their own objections. So I just would point that out, that you do have a letter in regards to them. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You're not Dave Barrows.
But I'm not. Would you like Dave Barrows?
Oh, heck no.
You probably need a change of scenery. I'm Julia Brim Edwards, the Deputy Director for State and Public Affairs for Nike. The Dash 6 Amendment is amendment relating to the Nike exemption. It's fairly straightforward. It changes the sunset date of the exemption for the Nike campus from 2020 to 2040. And the reason for the change in the sunset date is it mirrors the timeline of our planning and investment process. We currently have future plans for 4 new buildings on our campus to accommodate both current and future growth. These 4 new buildings are 2 major office buildings, another child care center. We currently, on the Nike campus, have the largest child care facility for our employees in the state, and yet we still have a very long waiting list. So another child care center is on the books, and also a parking structure. The planning and ramp-up time for building is approximately 3 to 5 years, and then you add another 30-plus years useful life of the building, and so you get a timeline of about 35 years. So that's why the dates change to 2040 in the Dash 6 Amendment.
Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Greenberg.
Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Does this extension, my understanding is Columbia Sportswear is also included in this amendment, in this bill. Does this amendment relate to Columbia Sportswear as well?
Yes, that's correct.
And ESI is not included in this section in its current form, is that right?
I believe there may be a different amendment.
Okay.
They're not in this.
They're not in this, and we don't have an
amendment. They're not in the bill currently as it exists.
We might want that if we go in this direction. And Tektronix is a separate amendment, I take it.
Yes, that's coming up next.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. You're always much more welcome than is Dave Grouse. And he knows I'm just kidding.
Right.
Let's go to Mr. Conklin, who can tell us about the Dash 10s and Dash 11s.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Gary Conklin, here today representing Tektronix, Inc. We're the people that brought forward both Amendments 10 and 11, which are amendments in the alternative that have two different sunset dates on them. The Amendment number 10 would conform the sunset date to the existing bill, Senate Bill 887, and number 11 would conform it with the amendment you just heard about if the sunset date was extended to 2040. What I'd like to do, if I may, because Tektronix has a slightly different situation regarding annexation protection, if I might just give you a couple of moments of background. In 1987, Tektronix sought and was given protection against forced annexation for its industrial campuses in Beaverton. At that time, it had two. The company made the case then that annexation to Beaverton would result in lesser quality urban services, and specifically fire and emergency services and building permits, but do so at a higher cost. It also noted the history that Beaverton had declined to offer urban services to the fledgling company when it purchased its campus in the 1950s. That prompted Tektronix to champion the formation and growth of a number of large special districts which currently serve Eastern Washington County today and are the providers of virtually all of our urban services. The original annexation protection afforded Tektronix carried a two-year sunset, which was designed at that time to provide a cooling-off period between the city and one of its major industrial neighbors, which at that time was Oregon's largest private employer. And it worked. We returned to the 1989 legislature, asked for an extension of the protection, and a 20-year extension was granted. And that sunset, which is in current law, expires in 2009. And it is that sunset date is the one that my amendment relates to. It's worth noting that since 1989, relations between Tektronix and the city of Beaverton have flourished. With the threat of annexation removed, the corporation and the city talk and act on a basis of mutual interest. For example, Tektronix agreed to give the city two private roads that Beaverton wanted to enhance its street grid in a congested commercial area east of our campus and north of Tualatin Valley Highway. As part of this arrangement, Tektronix sold an unused portion of its campus to a private developer, which became an anchor for the redevelopment of an older shopping center, then known as Beaverton Mall, which added new property value to the city. The streets and that portion of the campus that was sold were annexed to Beaverton by consent. Tektronix and Beaverton have also collaborated on light rail and a park and ride lot, as well as a number of other projects that benefit both the city and the corporation. So what was undertaken once upon a time as a tool to stop unwanted annexation has actually emerged as a successful instrument for mutual cooperation. So my purpose here today is to seek conformance with other companies in the Beaverton area with sunset dates. They're following the pattern that I just described that I think has actually produced a positive result, and I think it would make sense for the companies involved, since we all are basically talking about the same area, to have the same sunset date. I would ask your consideration of either amendment number 10 or number 11, depending upon your other decisions about what date you might choose. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions of Mr. Conklin? Thank you, Gary. Representative Greenwick is going to explain the dash 12s.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, I have real problems with 222750 as it's been applied, because I don't think it's been applied the way it was intended. But the purpose of including A12, which repeals 222750, is this understanding. We set in 887 a task force. We sort of set a task force. We may want to do something with that language, but we sort of set an interim task force that looks at the whole question of annexation, and I think that's an important thing to do and makes some sense. But in, even in my limited experience here, this being my second term, it's clear to me that interim task forces sometimes work and sometimes don't. And one of the things that makes them not likely to work is if there isn't any hammer, if there isn't any consequences to not doing anything. And I'm afraid the way 887 is in its current form, there aren't any consequences. We've had two experiences with this committee, one on industrial lands and one on the whole rethinking of land use that we've been fooling around with now for 2 years without the interim work groups actually be able to do anything. I had a so the purpose of deleting this is to put some chips into the pot when this group gets to work. I had some conversation with Ms. Ludwig on this. She has a problem with it in this form. I propose that what might be an equivalent way to do this is to delay the implementation of this section until January of 2008. That would give the interim group lots of time to create a look at annexation, to do what needs to be done to make 222750 structured so it does what it was intended to do, to allow little pockets to be annexed when it makes sense to do that. But if that group didn't come to us with recommendations that actually made sense, this would implement that repeal at the end of the next legislative session. It would give us plenty of time to delete that implementation and a variety of other things. So I intend to propose another amendment that will do exactly that, that will delete 222750, that will repeal 222750 effective January 1st of 2008. And it seems to me the cities haven't agreed that that will change their mind on this, but it does give them something easier to look at in this discussion, and I will be coming back with that the next time we're meeting.
Okay, very good. Okay, we're now going to, I think we've covered all of the amendments, proposed amendments. Keep in mind that none of these amendments have been accepted by this committee as of this point, and will not be today. So let's begin our list, and I'll ask Linda Ludwig, Stan Pfeiffer, and Steve Mozart. Did I get that right?
I'll bet you it is.
Apologize, Steve. Are you from Albany? Okay, then you're the right Steve Bryant. lead off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. Mr. Culver had to leave the committee at this time, but he did indicate that he hoped to supply the committee with some written testimony via email to committee chair members. I did hand you a handout that I think you're receiving today, and I'm not going to read through it, but I do want to touch base on a couple of points here. As we know, annexation encourages job creation and economic development in cities by creating certainty and ensuring the services that businesses and our citizens need, sewer, water, transit, roads, public safety, the long-term planning aspects that cities do. Approximately 90% of all annexations are initiated by property owners or developers. They occur without conflict or controversy and are handled in a seamless manner. And I want to underscore that today. That is absolutely the case. That is the case because property owners want to be annexed because it allows them access to urban services, it adds value to their property, and it reduces costs for those services, reduce water, sewer rates. I did a small survey, a thumbnail survey for you, and you'll see that in the middle of the top page to show some of the growth in housing and job starts attributable to annexations over the course of the last 10 years for the most part. Springfield, the last 10 years, they've increased 2,000 homes, 1,000 new jobs with industrial land. At the time of the Peace Health build-out, they'll add an additional 1,500 jobs. As you go through this list, Corvallis, 100 homes, Albany stats are here. I'm sure Mr. Bryan can speak to that. In small communities such as Florence, in the last 10 years, 600 homes with 500 permanent jobs, that makes a large difference there in the small city of Flames. You heard from Representative Esquivel that annexations play out in many different ways in Oregon's 240 cities. That's absolutely true. Each city is unique, as well as each method of annexation that I think the committee is beginning to understand more and more about. The political environment of a particular city is unique, and the circumstances of an individual territory of development that are involved in annexation make it very difficult from a high level to make broad brush changes to, in this case, island annexation methodology without having some unintended consequences elsewhere. On the second page, just grab your attention to a couple of cities, Hillsborough and Salem, in terms of island annexations and how they handle that. You heard about Medford. Hillsborough allows the creation of new islands and does not require that a logical group of contiguous properties all join in on a single annexation. This has left them with a large number of islands involving about 257 parcels or lots with an AV, an assessed value of over $55 million in islands. Many of these parcels are developable, although some aren't, and they process them right now, today, as they have over the course of the last years, with only requests, about 10 to 25 requests per year, and they are satisfied that over the course of time, they will eventually annex all these properties on their own without a change of law. If we look at a change of law today without being very, very fastidious, it's going to make them think twice about creating any new islands because they would no longer be able to annex these islands when circumstances warrant such action. So there are some consequences we are looking at when we look at amendments that we have seen in committee to change the potential definition of what is an island, what types of boundaries change the definition of an island, such as a portion of roadway, or even repealing island annexation authority either at the end of legislative session or in 2008. City of Salem is here today. They also as well have a
that I have garnered about 220 acres in existing enclaves with an AV of about $13 million. All of those enclaved areas include a roadway or a road as a portion of that corporate boundary that surrounds the enclave area. And we may talk to that today a little bit further. You've heard me before propose that a joint legislative committee on an interim committee be formed to look at annexation methodology as we utilize it today, and that be connected to the joint legislative interim committee. And to that end, the league would offer staffing assistance over the interim to facilitate these logistical items of that interim committee. We are absolutely compelled to look at annexation, both long-term and the goals of having an efficient, logical provision of services. And I think that the interim committee is the best way to address that issue at this time. So our position is that 87 is a bill that we could support without amendments. I know there are some amendments that we have seen today, but I haven't had time to really nitpick through in terms of the mediation process, the couple that we've seen there today. We certainly, in its current form, would not be able to support the Dash 12 amendments that repeal island annexation authority. And we would also ask you that you not pass, and I know we're not hearing this bill today, but the other annexation bill that we heard last week, 3084, with island annexation amendment provisions to it.
Ms. Gunn, would you represent the League of Oregon Cities? Is the city of Beaverton here today?
There are no staff or elected officials from the city of Beaverton today. However, I did see earlier in the committee room a lobbyist for them, but I'm not sure that they are today here.
I don't want to particularly pick you up by the hair and shake you on this thing, but I apologize for that. I'm just so, how long have we been talking about this issue of annexation with the city of Beaverton, and yet here they go, 9 days ago, still annexing against people's wishes. What part of this process don't they understand? Or are they just saying, we don't care what the people think, we don't care what business thinks, and we don't care what this legislature thinks? Is that the answer we're getting from the city of Beaverton? Because your task force is running out the door on you at this point, because we're not going to take a chance. If Beaverton won't listen to what we're trying to tell them now, what are they going to do in 2 years while you have a task force with no teeth to it? They'll have Portland before too much longer.
I want to note for the record that that was not me that said that, but I represented it from Clive Falls.
Yeah, I don't have a dog in the fight, so it's kind of nice.
Mr. Chair,
and I don't mean to pose that question to you, Ms. Ludwig, because you're not responsible for the city of Beaverton.
Thank you.
But you're just the closest target, so to speak. So.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I understand your questions. I, too, wish they were here today to answer them directly to you. I will just mention that 887 does have a provision that directly impacts the city of Beaverton and doesn't impact the rest of the cities of the state of Oregon. And as an unusual position as that is for the league to be taking in support of that bill, 887 as it currently stands, it is a position that we have been having to take because of the lack of the city here telling you their story, and which I do not have the ability to be able to do that and share that with you today.
I mean, here we are, committee, hearing a bill that's already passed through the Senate. This is the last step, this committee, and then the House floor, and then to the governor. And the city of Beaverton doesn't care?
They're moving fast. We need to.
They're too busy annexing to show up,
I guess.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your humor.
I'm glad you do. I don't mean to aim it right at you, but there you are. Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Bryant. I had some prepared comments. I didn't distribute them because in light of what I've heard so far and the explanation of the amendments, I thought I'd better go back and revise them. I'm going to speak to you a little bit in general terms based on my experience annexing or being involved in annexations for many years, and then show you some specific examples of how we've applied that. And relative to your last comments, I want to make clear that my position and that of most of the other cities, I think, that would want to share comments with you are that don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Anything that you want to do relative to Beaverton, I guess you need to do, but I just hope that the other amendments that might affect all other cities throughout the state, you view in a different light, because...
Mr. Bryant, that's the question this committee is going to have to wrestle with.
I understand that.
Is to punish every other city in this state, in essence, for the actions of one.
Mr. Chair, I do like to pick on Beaverton because it's so easy to do lately and because 25,000 of my constituents would like me to, but the truth of the matter is what Beaverton is showing as an example, because the mayor of Beaverton has read our laws in a particular way and read the county and believes he's doing what he actually was instructed to do, could happen in any other city. It could happen in Klamath Falls. It could happen in Albany. It could happen in Eugene. And to a certain extent, it has happened in some of those cities. But so I don't think this is an issue that Beaverton's the bad guy, and I don't think we need to change the laws because Beaverton has been doing something. I think what we need to understand is here's a mayor operating in the way he believes the laws are interpreted, operating within the laws of the state of Oregon, and it might not have been Beaverton that did it. It might have been Corbett. It might have been anywhere. And I think that's why we're looking at this, not to beat up on Beaverton, but because we need to put the laws in a way that ultimately makes sense. And I hope that's what the task force is really doing. So while it's kind of fun to pick on Beaverton, I don't think Beaverton is exactly the issue. I think they're simply exhibiting behavior that any other mayor could do.
Well, again, I'll have to disagree with you a little bit because you get thrown in jail for robbing the bank, not thinking about robbing the bank.
That's a new corollary to Willie Sutton principle.
I can tell it's going to get more and more difficult. But I'd like to speak to the general principles involved here, and I think it's important for us to consider the context. And set stage a little bit. I'm retiring in a few weeks after 31 years in this business, and I was thinking as I walked through the doors of the Capitol today, might this be my last time testifying on annexation reform, because I think I've been doing it for 30 years.
So this committee didn't have anything to do with that decision?
I understand that. Okay. No, it did not. But looking back on that history, beginning when I began, shortly after the adoption of Senate Bill 100, I think about the years that I've spent in trying to comply with the intent of Oregon's fairly unique land use system, wherein we have tried to set in place a system that encourages and, in fact, mandates that cities grow efficiently and logically, and that we extend urban services before we extend those services, that we plan for urban services within our urban growth boundaries, that we spend millions of dollars preparing public facility plans showing how we're going to extend sewer and water services and transportation systems within our acknowledged urban growth boundary, and that we provide a 20-year supply of buildable land that's a mandated requirement within our urban growth boundary. But we don't have the tools to ensure that the land, in fact, is available to us to implement those planning decisions. And one of those tools is annexation. Now, over the years, I've been involved in many forms of annexation, health hazard annexations, two of those. Those are the most onerous type of annexation. And talk about people who don't want to be forced into a city, try going through a health hazard annexation. I've done it twice. It's not a pleasant experience. But it was absolutely necessary because we had people who literally had sewage flowing in open ditches, and the public's health truly was at risk. But there were many individuals that did not want to be forced into the city and be forced to connect to expensive sewer systems. But we did it. We went through that process, a very deliberative process. We've done many island annexations over the years, and I'm going to show you some examples of that and why that tool is absolutely necessary for the logical extension of city services. It's, of course, natural for property owners to resist city taxation when they can avoid it, while still benefiting many from the services that cities provide. I think that's quite understandable. In our case, we're the provider of public library service. There is no county library system. Everybody who's in an unincorporated area around Albany gets the benefit of the libraries that our city pays for with our property taxes, but that's available to them without charge, although they can purchase a non-city resident fee. But we provide the infrastructure for that. We provide the urban transportation system. We provide the public safety services, and we even contract and provide all of the rural fire protection in our area. I think the other piece of context that's important to recognize here is that Measure 37 has given property owners in rural areas and unincorporated areas new rights that they didn't have before to develop their properties or to make claims for waivers or compensation as a result of their long-time ownership of property. I guess the point is that the most important point is that we have these requirements to ensure the efficient provision of urban services without all the tools in our toolbox to make it happen. The map that I have given you shows you the islands that we've annexed just in the last year. There were 8 of them, and it's hard to tell from this map because some of them are so small they barely show up. In many cases, they're single pieces of property that as a result of years of annexation have created small enclaves. And of the 8 annexations that we proclaimed in the last year, only one was contested. 7 were not contested. We had public hearings and no one showed. One was contested, and in fact we're still dealing with an appeal on that annexation. We're one of the cities, one of the growing numbers of cities that requires a citywide election on all annexations. So one of the reasons that I suspect many enclave annexations are not contested is that they realize they have expanded development potential if they're annexed. They don't have to go through the expense of funding a separate annexation election for those annexations. The city does it for them through the island annexation process. We submit it to the voters. They're voted on, and they have all been approved.
Mr. Bryant, when you say the voters, which voters?
Well, under state law, it is the voters of the city. The voters of the territory are given an opportunity to come at a public hearing and express their desires.
But they're not given an opportunity to vote.
They're not given an opportunity under state law, as I understand it presently, for an election. Now, they certainly could choose to annex under the consent method or the double majority method, and many of them do. But in the enclave situation, present construct of state law does not give them the opportunity to participate in the election. Usually the numbers are so insignificant that it probably would not have a bearing on the outcome, but that is the case.
I mean, compared with the city vote?
Correct.
Okay. What would usually be the case? I couldn't think of, well, the city would not number any
Right. This is if you look at the map that I've given you, the largest of these islands is on the left side of your map. It's shown in red there, and what makes it an island is it's bordered on one side by a body of water, as described in statute, and on the other side by the corporate limits of the city. That's an area that has about 300 acres and 60 homes. It's often referred to as Mortgage Row in Albany, very expensive homes. If you look at that street labeled Broadway Street, it's a street where you can't tell what's in the city and what's out of the city. The areas in white are in the city. The areas in red were outside of the city.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Was that annexed under 22275?
Yes, it was.
Because of the river?
Yes, that is correct. The property owners there for many years have benefited from police patrols that have gone up and down those streets. They have benefited, in fact, from city water service. We happened to purchase the water system in 1984 from Pacific Power, which owned it prior to that time, so they already had city water. And I would argue they benefit from the city parks, virtually everything that the city pays for. But naturally, they were resistant to annexation. The only way you can get to that neighborhood is through traveling on city streets. So we went through, I guess, what we would call a very involved process of public hearings and negotiations on what the zoning would be and what services they would receive, ultimately resulting in an annexation under 222750. The voters overwhelmingly approved that annexation, but it is currently on appeal. So I just want to say that of the eight that we did just in the last year, again, seven were uncontested and went quite smoothly. One is still being contested, but I would argue it still is a tool that that works. And in that case, we'll go through a process to make sure that those citizens, in fact, receive the services for which they will now be paying. The last thing I would say is that citizens are demanding that governments operate more efficiently. And if you can imagine any kind of governmental entity in which enclaves are allowed to exist and benefit from the services of that entity, think in terms of a state, if you will, you're responsible for the state of Oregon. Imagine, if you will, that there were enclaves in the state of Oregon that were not subject to the laws of the state or the taxes that the rest of us have to pay, and yet you were expected to provide services efficiently to that jurisdiction. It wouldn't be a very efficient way to run a government, and it isn't at the municipal level. So I think that it's a tool that has to be part of the toolbox that we have if we're going to implement the 20-year housing supply requirement that we have, if we're going to implement the public facility plan requirements that we have, and if we're going to avoid having to annex prime resource land because of the resistance from these kinds of enclaves. In other words, if we're going to meet our 20-year housing supply and cannot annex the areas that are surrounded by the city, the other alternative is to go out into the EFU lands or timber lands and annex property to meet that 20-year housing supply. So again, please don't take a one-size-fits-all approach. Leave us some of the tools that are important to us, and with that, I'll try to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Byrne as a representative?
Let's talk about the left-hand piece.
Sure.
Let's say the river didn't run there.
Right.
Let's say the river ran some other way. How would you have been able to annex that?
We would not have been able to accept through some sort of consent process. I would argue, though, in that case,
the city would have fallen down then because the rule would have come to an end, obviously.
Actually, if you look at that, that's also our urban growth boundary. Had the river not been there, I would submit that the urban growth boundary wouldn't have been there. The urban growth boundary might have been either closer in or further out. Who knows? But as it exists today, there is no other way into that neighborhood except by traveling on city roads. So, again, there would never be any incentive for any of those property owners to consent to annex. They already have city water, would benefit from city fire protection, city police services, city libraries, city parks.
Why did you give them those services?
Pardon?
Why did you give them those services?
The water existed before the city owned the water system. The police protection is there simply because, as you can see, with the properties in and out of the city, we're patrolling those streets anyway to protect those residents that are inside the city. It's confusing when the 911 call comes in, when they have to figure out, okay, is this an address that's in the city or out of the city? You can see, just going down Broadway Street, the city limits changes probably 8 times in the course of about 500 feet. So there's confusion there. There are no county parks anywhere close to the city of Albany. We provide 27 park facilities. These people use those parks. They benefit from those services. They do not pay taxes to support it. They benefit from our senior center. We allow them free access to that. They benefit from our library. But they have no incentive to annex. Their houses are there. There's very little other developable land there. It's mostly floodplain and open space. So that would be our dilemma. There's just no other means to efficiently draw the city limit line around that area but for 222-750.
Okay.
How about democracy? Any further questions of this panel? Ms. Ludwig, again, I wanted to make sure that you understood that when I asked you whether the city of Beaverton was present, it was so that I could direct my abuse at them and not at you, okay?
Mr. Chair, I absolutely understand that.
Good. Thank you. Jerry Ritter, Harvey Matthews, and Dana Krosick, if I got the name right. I messed it up, huh?
That's terrible. We're going to miss a couple.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Ritter. I'm here representing Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexations, and thank you for allowing us the opportunity to again testify on annexation reform. We support Senate Bill 887A, and Representative Greenlick, I hope we were successful in keeping the dog pound doors closed, as you asked us to do. Hopefully you folks haven't heard a whole lot of barking, at least from our kennel, on this yet.
Thank you.
We think you're all familiar with the bill and its purpose, so that we don't really have to explain it to you from our perspective. We can support it as written. We do have some concerns that we would like you to consider and to see if they can possibly be addressed without endangering the life of the legislation. Our biggest concern is, how do we reconcile the ORS 195 reforms in 887A with those that were enacted with House Bill 2484? I guess enacted is the wrong term. It hasn't been enacted yet. 2484 clarifies the ORS 195 provision as double majority with no sunset. 887A sunsets it and does not allow city voters to take part in the vote. So we see a discrepancy there. We're not sure how best to resolve it. Our strong preference, and that of those who worked on 2484, is that the language in the House bill should apply. We really don't want to see a sunset on the 195 reforms. And in discussing Beaverton and any one city in particular, 195 is a statewide issue. It doesn't just deal with Beaverton. It deals with Bend, Redmond, who have used the law, and other cities that have considered it. It's a statewide issue. Representative Crummell has discussed this matter with legislative council. Our understanding is that council does not see a conflict. We're not quite sure why that is. But I've asked Representative Crummell to discuss that with you folks. I provided Representative Ackerman with an email that I received from Representative Crummell's office describing that discussion he had with LC, and would ask you to review that. Second item, restriction on island annexations in Beaverton only. I think Representative Greenlick has already addressed that. Be aware that island annexations are not confined to Beaverton either. Our Eugene UGB chapter especially doesn't want to be left out of these types of protections. So it's not just a one city issue. If there is going to be a moratorium on island annexations, we would prefer to see it enacted statewide. The biggest problem with islanding is when cities do it intentionally by annexing streets through cherry stemming. That's where we really started to get into problems with this business. So you might want to consider that in your deliberations. Third item, protection against forced annexation for only a couple of businesses. Mr. Matthews is going to address that a little bit further, so I'll keep it brief. Fundamentally, we think that protection for one ought to be protection for all. And our final item, turning the problem over to a task force, Representative Greenlick, you addressed that very well. When the chairman and I originally discussed this, there was a hammer provision included to whereby at least some meaningful reform would happen if the task force did not achieve its goal. Now, you're all aware that the legislature has greatly increased its use of task forces to try to solve problems in the last few sessions, and the success rate of these is somewhat limited. I think everyone knows what the issues are here. We've been debating them in this body for the last 6 years, and the questions all fundamentally come down to one, and that is, do the people who are most impacted by an annexation, should they have a meaningful and effective voice in the process, or should we just allow the status quo to continue? It all really boils down to that. This committee rendered a 6-0 yes on that question with House Bill 2484. Your chamber colleagues backed you up solidly 45-13 on the same question. What we and what I think you all want to avoid is tossing this same football around for the next 2 years without putting any points on the board. And that's our concern with a task force. If there's going to be a task force, there needs to be some incentive for it to get something done. In conclusion, we see Senate Bill 887A as a critical second leg of annexation reform effort in the present session, and while we can support it as written, and we don't want to encumber it so much that it endangers the life of the bill, we think the foregoing issues deserve consideration. We would ask you to give them consideration in your deliberation, keeping in mind that timeliness is also a matter for consideration. This committee has earned our trust. I'm very thankful for that. You've made a lot of friends around the state in the last couple of months, not necessarily among powerful lobbyists, but certainly among the people of the state of Oregon, whose name appears at the top of this in all legislation, and we're very grateful to your service and your support. I'd like to comment just a little bit on what the representative from Albany indicated on the citywide votes on annexations. Those are local charter amendments that 30 cities around the state have chosen to enact, mostly by the initiative process. They allow city residents only to make the final vote on discretionary annexations. Now, in the case of an island annexation, such you described from Albany, that's an island. They weren't going to get a vote anyway under that rule. The city vote is simply another political step, not a land use decision, but another political step in the process. Double majority annexations under ORS 222 satisfy that requirement because the city people are having a voice. 195 satisfies it, although unfairly so, because the city people have a voice. So that concludes my testimony. Thank you very much for your service. Let's get something done in this session and make it meaningful. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions you have.
Will we continue the whole panel and then we'll take questions?
Yeah.
Harvey?
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries, representing 23,000 Oregon businesses across the state. One of AOI's guiding principles is to promote cooperative and consistent regulation throughout the state, and Senate Bill 887A is in direct opposition to this principle. As a result, we're opposing Senate Bill 87A and would move to support Representative Greenlick's Dash 12 amendment in its stead. Senate Bill 887A is not consistent. It's not fair to other businesses in Beaverton that have been annexed or will be annexed outside the window that's specified within that area. And while certain businesses may be able to hire lobbyists, that for every one of those businesses, there are 10 other Leupold and Stevens that won't be adequately protected by this very narrow application of statute. It's not fair to the other sports wire and apparel companies who pay city taxes within Oregon. This is one of our critical industries, and to set up one company is being protected from that taxation while the others are taxed is not consistent or fair. The Dash Home Amendments would strip the bill of any Beaverton-specific language and replace it with statewide policy to deal with the annexation issue effectively in both the short and the long term. By eliminating the provision in ORS 222750 that allows cities to practice island annexation, it still allows cities to annex through the consent of the landowner, which is in 222050. And by retaining Section 4 of the bill, which directs the interim committee to construct possible alternatives to the current system of annexation with the goal of improving Oregon's long-term economic vitality, I think you have a structure there that could prove to be very effective. These amendments, this amendment, -12, provides a framework for a thoughtful statewide approach to annexation that would meet AOI standards for consistency and cooperation amongst the business community and with local government. Thank you.
Thank you. Deb?
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Dana Krafchak. I'm a land use attorney at Baljanic, and I represent W.B. Wells and Bold LLC, two of the property owners that are currently appealing Beaverton's island annexation to LUBA. I'd like to give you a brief history of how we got here. I know we've heard this a number of times, but from my property, my client, property owner's perspective, they didn't want to end up at LUBA. They're just there protecting their legal rights. After an abrupt shift in the city of Beaverton's policy to not forcibly annex properties, in November of 2004, they began targeting non-geographically connected, non-residential properties that did not have voters in them for the purposes of increasing their tax base. There's no deficiencies in urban services that have been identified. Washington County is unique with the regional service and shared service districts. Without talking to property owners, there was the shift in annexation policy, and Beaverton proceeded in these hostile annexations, and they continue to, as we discussed earlier in this hearing. Beaverton has agreed to take a small step back and study in collaboration with Washington County who the appropriate service providers are and what the possible appropriate annexation boundary would be. This is something we certainly support, but despite this study, the city has proceeded with these island annexations. In light of this experience, my clients support the direction of Senate Bill 887. Specifically, we agree that island annexations should be prohibited, either across the board or specific to the city of Beaverton based on their track record. We also support the concept of future boundaries work groups to mediate issues. Our request, though, is to have these concepts apply to the very annexations that precipitated this bill. But without this measure for fairness, we're concerned that it was our hardship that has brought these issues to light. And there will be studies that are done, and they will determine if properties should be annexed or if urban services need to be changed. But it's too late for us. Our legal appeal will proceed. We hope we're successful. But if we're not, we're stuck in a city. That's a disadvantage to us. So what we request that you do is that you amend the bill so that any prohibition on Beaverton or other jurisdictions to utilize the island annexations is retroactive to March 1st, 2005. The idea of having a retroactive nature isn't new. It's in the engrossed version of the Senate bill. We just like for it to be clarified that it applies not only to specific properties, ones that meet the characteristics in Section 5 and Section 6. Instead, it applies across the board. That way, Beaverton's March 1st, 2005 annexations would be void. Our LUBA appeals would go away. The annexations from 7 days ago would go away. They would be void. That would preserve the rights of the property owners that have been annexed against their will while the task force studies what the appropriate manner for annexing properties is. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
questions? Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, so this is to Mr. Ritter and with some help from Representative Greenleck. Mr. Ritter, you testified in favor of Senate Bill 887. We have the 12-12 amendments. I don't think you and I have reviewed those, but I just want to confirm with Representative Greenleck that the dash 12s take out the Section 3 of the A of Gross Senate Bill, which provided for a single majority for OS 195 annexations. It seems like it does to me.
We take out the Beaverton piece.
Okay, but...
Because it would take out 2275 right now. What right. Other pieces it would take out?
Well, I have the dash 12s was taken out...
Four through 19.
It takes out
pages 2, 3, and 4.
Pardon?
And pages 2, 3, and 4.
Right, but Section 3 in the A and Gross Bill has a single majority required for ORS 195 types of annexations. Did you intend to take that out?
No,
too?
I did not intend to take that out.
Okay. Well, we have some more work to do, Mr. Ritter and I.
But it does take it out. But it does take it out.
The conversation is whether any of the amendments that we have would refer back to a remedy as far as the annexations that occurred before March 1st. Is that the discussion?
No, the discussion is whether it took out the 095. The 195 piece of the bill, line section 2, line 8 and 9 on the first page, and it does take it out and not put it back, but
we'll take corrective action, I think, to do that. If that was...
Yeah, wasn't much of work that obviously.
Any other questions in this panel?
Yeah, I had a question, sir, that I simply would like to know whether the appeal stopped that annexation.
I think it will result in part on the result of the appeal. If LUBA remands the city's decision, I think arguably the decision's not effective. If we're not successful at a LUBA appeal, then the decision's effective as of March 1st, 2005. So I think this is an opportunity for the committee to send a clear message that what they intend is for this to apply not only to future annexations, but to undo the actions that got us where we are today.
But the question is, what's the current status of that annexation? Is that annexation in abeyance because of the appeal, or is the annexation in a force
for the properties that have appealed it to LUBA, and there's four property owners that have those are in abeyance.
Those are in abeyance at the moment.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Dan. Glenn Gross and Sean O'Day, both in the city of Salem. And then, committee, we have two remaining folks who would like to testify. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sean O'Day. I'm an assistant city attorney for the city of Salem. I'm here today with Glenn Gross. He's our urban planning administrator. It's a pleasure to be here today with you today to testify about annexation. Annexation issues are invariably, as we've seen today, difficult. But my message here today is quite simple. Any revision to ORS Chapter 222, Oregon's annexation laws, must be deliberative and comprehensive so the full impacts of the revisions are well understood. Oregon citizens will not be well served through piecemeal legislation in this area. Otherwise, we run the risk of creating unintended consequences. The issue that's gotten a lot of attention today and the issue that I want to specifically highlight is that of island annexations, also known as enclave annexations. As our colleague from Albany so aptly put, there are many cities that are going about this the right way for the right reasons. The island annexation tool is one to bring parts, territory that is islands or within city limits into the city limits, and the rationale for doing so is that those individuals are often the property owners or the residents who are living in that area are often benefiting from city services and are not paying for those services. Specifically, those services would include police, fire, parks, recreation, library, or some of the examples that you've heard already today.
I've heard a lot about questions about, you know, this bill is about having those who are impacted by the city's decision to annex have a voice in that process. I don't necessarily disagree with that, and I think that there is a public process, and I'll let Mr. Gross explain what our process is, and you can see that there is a public process involved. But by taking away the island annexation tool, what you've effectively done is taking the rest of the citizens' voice away. Those citizens, the rest of the citizenry within the city, that is essentially subsidizing those services for those individuals. Excuse me, been suffering from a cold, two children at home, it kind of comes with the territory. By taking away the island annexation tool, what you've essentially done is eliminated the citizens within the city from having their voice heard. And those, and again, those are the citizens who are effectively subsidizing the services for the others. I want to just touch on a few more things that Mr. Bryant didn't cover. I want to note that doing away with island annexation is inconsistent with Oregon's growth management laws. It's inconsistent with the intent of the UGA. Without the ability to annex islands, and in this case, let's assume that the island is an undeveloped area within the city, it prevents us from being able to provide infill within the UGA. In other words, we can't provide services to that property. That property can't develop without those services. And without, so the consequence of taking away the island annexation tool from cities is to effectively hinder economic development in those areas. Where those areas are already built up, I want to also note that it often hurts the individuals who are located within that area. A specific example that I've recently been working on, we have a city, and a part of the city, it's a low-income area, that has a private water system. Residents within this part of the city pay $4 a month for their water service, so it's a heck of a bargain for them. The water system is managed by a resident in the area, and that resident happens to be moving out of the area and is no longer going to be managing the water system. There are no other residents who feel comfortable doing so, and so they've come to the city, and they're now asking for our help. I submit to you that this situation is the result of the city not being able to do an island annexation. If we had been on top of things, the water system that would have been in place would have been a city system. Instead, what we're stuck with right now is a water system that, by state standards, if the city were to come in and take it over, we would have to rebuild at significant cost to those residents. In short, this is about smart planning. I want to note that in closing here that Senate Bill 887 includes the task force provision. We support using that task force to do a comprehensive review and ensure that we do not encounter these unintended consequences that prevent cities from providing essential services or costing their citizens money. We respectfully request also that the community consider creating a space on that task force for a city, for a representative from the city of Salem to participate. As the state's second largest city and the home of the state capital, where our tax base is significantly impacted by the large amounts of property that is held in public ownership, we believe we can add both a great deal to the discussion of these issues as well as work towards a comprehensive, responsible, and sound solution to the issues that this bill is intended to address. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions at this time? Representative Ackerman.
Yes. Are you familiar with any municipalities in the state where the unincorporated areas receive most of their services, not from the adjoining city, but pursuant to regional systems and special service districts?
There are. I think that what you could do, if one were to perform a study of this, and so my comments here are largely anecdotal, those services that are provided by a special service are generally more along the utility types of services. So you see the water, the sewer, but the traditional city services, fire, police, transportation, you're not going to find the special service districts providing those services in those areas.
Suppose you had an unincorporated area that was receiving 75% of its services from regional providers and special service districts. Does that argue more in favor for a vote of the people to come in, a vote of the people in the unincorporated areas to associate with the city?
I appreciate the question, and let me note something. As I was preparing my remarks for today, I spent some time speaking with our city attorney, Randall Tosh, who's been representing municipalities in the state for approximately 10 years, mostly along the South Coast, cities of Coos Bay and the city of Salem. I want to note that what he remarked to me was that in the 10 years of practice, he has yet to see in the cities that he represents an island annexation occurring where the residents themselves were not in favor of it. I'm going to let Mr. and I'm telling you just for the cities that he represented. I mean, clearly there are cases within the state, but I want to dispel the myth that this is a common problem in the state of Oregon. And as Mr. Gross will note here in a minute, there is a public process that allows those individuals to be heard. They may not get a vote, but they are not silenced in any means in having any influence on the decision.
I don't think my question was answered. My question was, if the unincorporated area is receiving 75% of its municipal services from special service districts and regional systems, aside from the city, doesn't that argue in favor of having those folks vote before they are annexed into the city?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I think that if it was 75% of total services, including police, fire, parks, library, and the other services that cities provide, then yeah, that would be a compelling argument, but that's simply not the case here in Oregon.
It's the case in River Road, Santa Clara, where I reside.
Well, it's not here in Salem.
I can
speak to Salem, and I can say that
we're
in the situation
that,
here.
I just want to make that notation. Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Gross?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, first of all, I'd just like to say we do appreciate the difficult job you have, and we appreciate legislation that promotes economic development and livability for our city. However, our city council has gone on record already expressing its opposition to any legislation that would make it more difficult to force cities to annex land. In fact, our Mayor Taylor testified against Senate Bill 887 and several other annexation bills before the Senate Environment and Land Use Committee on March 14, 2005. Having said that, enclave or island annexations are an important tool for us. Our experience in recent years for the city of Salem has been this tool has been used as a voluntary method of annexing. Our charter allows for annexation by petition, and so our experience has been that folks petition the city to annex, and if they're in an enclave, they can be considered by the council outside the normal election process, which is the other way that we annex, which would require a vote. I guess I just want to stress.
Chair, can I ask?
Yes.
Would that be on
222050?
Go ahead.
It would be. There is the statutory process, and what Mr. Gross is referring to is a process that overlays that. So the statutory provision that you referenced is the base authority for that. If you took that away, then this overlaying process...
That's not a question here at all. You understand that?
I'm sorry?
I say nobody's objecting to 222050, to the voluntary annexations. You do understand that?
Yes, the voluntary. Understood. Right.
Yeah, well, I think we're just trying to point out that in our case, it is voluntary action typically. We just wouldn't want to lose the tool for the future. Without being able to infill, without being able to better coordinate code enforcement issues and so forth with islands of unincorporated areas, that makes it very challenging to promote efficient provision of services for our city. So we encourage you to not do anything that makes it more difficult for the city of Salem to annex. That's it.
Any further questions on this panel? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Supposing we do allow some of these islands to continue, like, for instance, the Beaverton one. Is there a way that you would suggest that, that would make that more fair? Obviously, you're not paying county taxes or property taxes. Is there a way that would balance that? Something that possibly the task force might look toward?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think that's an excellent question. It is one that should be directed at the task force. I can tell you that here within the city of Salem, we don't have experience in that to where I can really speak with any authority on that issue.
All right.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, it is interesting that both the City of Portland and the City of Salem have the same position. We don't do it involuntarily. And we've not done it involuntarily for 20 years, but we want to make sure we can do it in case we ever want to. That's an interesting position to me. I'm not sure what the basis of it is.
Mr. Chair, if I can respond, Mr. Greenlick, Representative Greenlick. I think that the reason why we're stressing that point to you is to show you that there is a public process involved here, that the individuals are not without a voice in this process, just as they're not without a voice in this process here today. Our city councils sit in hearings on these issues, just as you're sitting in a hearing today on this issue, and they hear much the same arguments that you're hearing today. I think that that practice reflects that reality, and that's the reason why we make that point.
And I would just add that we can't predict the future entirely. It may be that at some point in the future there will be a circumstance in the city of Salem where an involuntary annexation would be appropriate. I don't know that. I'm just saying that that's a possibility. So why would we support letting an option like that go? So it's just to keep our options open.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our final two committee to testify are Doug Riggs and John Chandler.
Oh, no. We have to look at Chandler this late in the afternoon.
Yeah. Move to adjourn, Mr. Mr. Riggs, you do have the opposition of testifying by yourself if you wish.
No, that's okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have been instructed to be brief, and I will attempt to be as brief as possible. I've had about an hour or so of testimony, but I'll skip over most of it at this point. I do have some written testimony that I'd like to leave for the record.
Take it, McGee's.
For the record, I'm Doug Riggs of the Central Oregon Cities Organization, which is Bend, Redmond, Mandarin, Prineville, Sisters, Bonneville, Metellus, and Culver. I'm also one of those powerful lobbyists that Mr. Ritter referred to a few moments ago. And I wanted to make a few points, some of which I made before the committee earlier this session. Let me just stress a couple of points. First of all, for fast-growing cities, annexation is often about economic development. And I think I used the example earlier of T-Mobile, which came into Redmond about 2 years ago, wanted to bring 600 or 700 jobs into the community. I was concerned that the annexation schedule was drawn out a little bit too long, and we reached an agreement with T-Mobile to accelerate the schedule to have a public vote and bring the property within our UGB in the city. Had that not been possible, and had these bills been in place, T-Mobile would not be in the state of Oregon right now. It would be in Idaho. And those 700 jobs in a community like Redmond, which has been struggling to find employment jobs for almost 10 years, would not be in the state, and we would not have them as an important part of the community. The second point I want to make, and I've made this before, is that I think there's a clear difference between the situation in Washington County or other areas in the Willamette Valley as opposed to small communities in Central Oregon. Washington County businesses, for example, receive sewer and water from special districts. There's a $2,000 fire and rescue organization that applies to the entire area. And so in most cases, you have a very different situation than you have in, say, Prineville, Redmond, or Bend, where the city is the main provider of those services. So I would make the request, again, that the committee look very carefully at considering the different nature of economic development in different parts of the state and not adopt a one-size-fits-all standard. The last point I want to make is specifically on Senate Bill 887.
I've had a number of conversations with Senate members who've been assured during consideration of the bill on the Senate floor that actually Senate Bill 887, specifically Section 3 of the bill, did not apply to anywhere except for either Washington County or Beaverton. And as I read the bill, it clearly imposes a requirement that a majority of the people in the territory vote in favor of any and all annexation during this two-year moratorium that we're imposing. That is quite different from the way that the bill was portrayed to at least one lobbyist who I've spoken to, as well as to one senator who I've spoken to. If that is a mistake in drafting, I would urge that this committee correct it.
It is not, Mr. Reed.
Okay. Well, in that case, we would oppose that section. I would say what I said, repeat what I said, I think, on Monday, which is we certainly acknowledge that the use of right-of-way annexations in an effort to create an island, which is what Beaverton has done, to then bring that island in the UGB, is probably a bit overreaching. And we would have no problem at this point with imposing, with changing that provision so it imposes the temporary two-year ban on that provision, which is what the committee did on Monday when they passed the Dash 5 amendments to House 3084, and we would certainly support that. Finally, I do want to say, speak not as a powerful lobbyist, but as a citizen of Tigard. I live on the bottom of Bull Mountain off of Walnut Street, and as you recall in Tigard, one of the things that I think got people upset about annexation was the attempted annexation of Bull Mountain. I live at the bottom of the hill in the less expensive housing areas. Many of my neighbors live up the street from me on houses that are 2, 3, 4, or 5 times more expensive than mine. They're in unincorporated Washington County. Every morning I watch as they drive down the hill on streets that I've paid for. They go to the parks that I paid for and my neighbors have paid for. They are protected during the time in the city of Tigard by police and fire services that are provided by the city of Tigard police services. And I guess what I would say is that, in my mind, I think it's entirely fair for a city to be able to ask the question of whether or not those properties ought to be part of the city. I go back to something that's on the first page of my testimony, which is that there is a fair process, and there's a balanced process, and every one of the people on both sides of the fence are represented. County commissioners represent the people in the unincorporated areas.
Mr. Riggs?
And, yes, sir.
Hang on.
Okay.
As a county commissioners can't stop a city annexation if the city is following the present law.
Mr. Chairman, at least in the annexations in which I've been involved, before a city can expand its UGB, which is a first step towards annexation, that requires the county to sign off on the comprehensive plan adopted by the city, which is the first step. So you're correct in that the annexation vote itself is not something the county commission can object to. But that first step, which is expanding the UGB, which is an expected step in the eventual annexation of a piece of property, is subject to county veto. And the county can veto that at one point in time. So there probably isn't enough public understanding in these communities that are going to be annexed at some point, but that's the point at which they need to be involved. And I would certainly agree with you that we need more due diligence to communicate with people in those territories that that's the case. But I've probably gone on far too long. You've heard much of what I've had to say before, and I certainly appreciate the time today.
Any questions of Mr. Riggs? Representative Greenlee.
No, I want to make a comment before Mr. Chandler starts.
Okay. Doug, I just want you to know that you have underlined here, and I really object to this, these county commissioners have the ability to stand in the way of any annexation. You finished the sentence by, say, by objecting to the comprehensive plan, but that to me is misleading. Because county commissioner, if a city owns the water supply, there's no way the county can stop an annexation. And it's not part of the comprehensive plan. So,
Mr. Chairman, if the sentence is misleading in any way, shape, or form, I apologize. The point I was trying to make is that during the process of adding land to the UGB, that has to be a collaborative, cooperative process between the city and its county commissioners. And state law actually, in many cases, requires the city and county to discuss who
who should be better at providing urban level services. So my probably should be a little more clear, but my point is that at the very beginning of the process, when the city works to expand its UGB, the whole point of expanding the UGB is to eventually bring that property in most cases. The only way you bring that land in the city is through an annexation. So I probably would have been more appropriate to say stay in the way of any UGB expansion.
I appreciate your remarks. Thank you very much. Mr. Chandler?
Mr. Chair, before Mr. Chandler starts, I just want to point out that he's the proponent of a proposal to make Section 1 more general by deleting the term the city of Beaverton and
who is he?
Also, Mr. Chandler, including all cities in Washington County whose name begins with a B, not counting banks.
Mr. Chairman, I just need me to be less of a slap at Beaverton if you snuck up on him in that way. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, I was frankly delighted to hear earlier that the penalty for today for irritating the chairman was to get swung around by the hair, because I believe that gave me a free pass. Now, you gave me a free pass.
Yeah, you're safe from that.
In light of the hour, I'll forego the pleasure. I'll be very, very brief. I hope when you work the bill again, that I'll have another chance to talk to you about it. This is an issue for my clients that's very important for a bunch of reasons, primarily because as jurisdictions squabble, or as citizens and their government squabble, we are the drive-by victims. We tend to, most of the time when we annex, developers annex, we do so voluntarily, we own the property, we buy it, we have options, we bring it in, not always. And from an economic development standpoint, not to mention my folks being able to keep doing what they're doing, we are deathly afraid that this system, which is already goobered up, which is a technical term, will become even more goobered through well-intentioned goobering. We would ask you to be very, very cautious. We support Senate Bill 887A as passed by the Senate. We worked with Senator Ringo very hard on it. I've had a number of conversations with some of you about this issue, trying to make sure that from our standpoint, we take no position on the other pieces of it, although I do think that the study group is essential. As I told you on other bills in this committee, we've known the annexation laws were a mess for 20 years, and we haven't done anything about it during this time. The pot has bubbled over. I think that the best thing you can do, this committee can do, and this chamber can do, is try to make sure that the grinding noises get fixed, but please don't create problems elsewhere trying to fix problem A. That's why I think the 887A bill is a very good attempt at narrowing the focus. I think Senator Decker's idea of a mediation process has some merit. I haven't thought it all the way through. But this is a tough issue. It's a tough issue for local officials. I was a member of the Redmond City Council in a previous life, and we had a fair number of gun battles over annexation. It's hard. Don't make it harder, please. I think that the bill in front of you is a good bill. I think it addresses the issues that I've heard about anyway during this session, and I would commend it to you. And with that, I will conclude. I'll take any questions you may have.
Any questions of Mr. Chairman? Nobody wants to take you on. Thank you both very much. Is there anyone else here who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 887A? Committee, we have some work to do in trying to sort through the amendments and which ones we want to do, which ones we do not want, what we're going to combine, what we are not going to combine. I suspect the best place to do that is in a work session, and we will schedule one for early next week on this. So in the meantime, please take a look at these amendments and decide which ones you are comfortable with, which ones you are not. There'll be a couple more coming.
Out of that work session, we may have other amendments that would be sort of the final go around.
Yes. I'm hoping so. We're not in a work session now, but I would hope that the retroactivity portion could be addressed. I think that's a proper request of this committee to consider that. Seeing no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.